Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, the immaculate. Now listen to this.
I'm not sure what's happening. Let me see if I can do this on my own. The show has started, but the switchboard hasn't. Waiting for host to dial in. I'm not even sure if I'm on the air. There I am. Hey. How about that? How about that? And how about this? Let's see. Where is it? Find it. And action. Action. It's going to be one of those nights, guys. Welcome to summertime. I'm your host, Dr. Mark, and this is the opening song. Please. What is it doing? Oh, I hate everything. Look at this. Amazing. Really is amazing. Being me. So now everything works, but nothing plays. All right, well, I want to open the show, but I can't do much here without this working, so I'm going to try to appeal to... I don't understand why it's not working. The buttons are there, and nothing's working. Let's see if we do this. Reload. See, show open number 9007 that we didn't get off to a good start because the technology is about as reliable as life itself. All right, let's see now, maybe... Will you play? Will you please play? Will you play anything? You won't play anything. Welcome to summertime. I'm your host, Dr. Mark, if you can hear me. Please call me. Let me know that I'm on the air and I'm still actually doing this show. Some would say it's been doing me, especially tonight so far, seeing as I had all that I could handle to get on the air. And now that I'm on the air, of course, nothing wants to work. But tonight is all about rivalries, facing your enemy, Eye of the Tiger, being able to handle the spiritual aspects of competition and be able to overcome obstacles on the way. Let's see what we play. Hey, I got it! Segments of things to do as we really take a closer look at the social aspects of the national pastime tonight. I'm going to take a little trip to the playpen. It's been really serious around here for a couple of weeks. So I figured, you know, let's look at some things that are kind of along the way. Oh, my God. All right, well, we're going to have one of those nights here on the show. I'm really just not going to get too upset. Amazing. The New York Mets have lost games on this road trip they're on. This is the seventh game of the road trip. Just tomorrow's the eighth, yeah. They're 1-5 right now, and they're in a tie game here in the seventh inning. And a guy that's not gotten a hit in about a week just basically poked his bat out of the ball and right down the third baseline, and he's now standing on second as the lead run. So they've had an inside the park home run in this game, the Mets, and they've also turned a triple play. You'd think that'd be enough to win. Not for them. Nope. They've lost on a wild pitch last week, and they lost a couple days ago. Actually, lost last night on an error by the third baseman. They've had any number of things befall them: injuries, weird calls by the umps. They're really under a little bit of a spell. And let's just take a look at the crosstown Yankees, fresh from their defeat last night at the hands of the Red Sox, which was kind of a salve for my Mets soul. Ooh, partly cloudy in 6-1 Tampa Bay as they play the bottom of the top of the sixth inning over in the Boogie Down. We'll take a look at that because there's nothing better than the sounds of a Yankee loss as they play Tampa Bay. First place Tampa Bay Rays, actually. So we'll be taking a look at that. Cubs are beating the Phillies so far. What are the Fish doing? Fish are tied with St. Louis. I think I saw the Braves were winning. Yeah, Braves are winning. So there you go. Look at the division. And so we're getting into some how these rivalries build up. We just went through Yankees-Red Sox. The Mets just came out and played a series with Atlanta. You know, some history there. This weekend Subway Series. Anyone going to that? Let me know. Tickets are still available, apparently, over at Citi Field. And just the role of baseball in the social conversation, because there's so many things going on with Arizona, of course, the All-Star Game and things like that, that where you see how the culture and baseball as a sport are so intertwined. There's so many things that, because it does take up, a huge portion of the year in terms of the season's so long, and the season has so many ebbs and flows to it that it really runs parallel to our lives in a lot of ways. And it's the soundtrack of the summer for some people like me. And I like to take a look at it periodically on the show because it's one of the best ways to learn about semantics because it has so many, subplots to it. So Nats move the runner over without bunting, but mind you. Yeah, that's true. The Mets have had the tying run, go-ahead run on second base in the ninth inning with nobody out in two of these games that they've lost in the bottom of the ninth. And they tried to bunt him over to third and get him in on a fly ball, and both times, of course, failed. So now the Nats have that opportunity. They got a runner on third and one out here in the seventh as they play down there in the nation's capital. Let me just see who the heck is up here. Looks like it'll be a cleanup hitter, no? Wait a minute. Wow. Oh, that was Bernardina, the guy that made all the catches against us that got that lucky hit. Okay, so they got a pinch hitter coming up here. Looks like this pitcher for the Mets. Is that Valdez? Yeah, Valdez is in. So they had the knuckleballer out there. He did pretty good for a bunch of innings. Third straight time the Mets have got a decent start. Hold on one second.
Yeah.
That would be the Mets choking again. So we'll see what happens here. Let's just tune in. Might as well simulcast this part. Looks like Jerry's going to take him out. Okay. Uh-oh. There's the Mets choke. You ready to play? Let's keep myself occupied here and see. Where is the Markov? The heck is it? This thing took it out. I don't see it anymore. Stinky Boots is there. Anyway. Elvis, what do you say about that?
What the fuck was he talking about?
That's right. Yeah, it's not there. Another one of those sneaky Pete things on the old BTR. So, all right. What? Okay. So anyway, as the Mets change pitchers, let's shift gears here and take a little look at the Woo. I did a Wootorial before. Let's see if I can play it for you. If you haven't listened to this before, this is a side discussion that took place a couple days ago on The View. And it really, you know, it kind of gives you a prime example of what, when you're dealing with the philo domain, when you're dealing with our tendency to bond as a group and deal with the differences between those groups, that's the whole point of this this show, is to understand the difference between an enemy versus an opponent, that kind of a thing. So here you have a political, polarizing figure in politics, Sarah Palin, who is wired to be a philo, wired to be someone who is a bonder, a natural bonder. But she sends messages out there that are not particularly easy to grasp, as it were, by the populace. So you get a lot of people going back and forth about what the things she says. So this is a discussion that took place a couple of days ago on The View. And let's see if I can just find it here, because this thing is driving me absolutely bad. It's amazing. Where is my stuff? Let's see if we go here. I'm actually kind of like, you know, more than a little, like, freaked out by Facebook lately. It's gotten so erratic. It's like, okay, there it is there, but where is it on my page? Okay. So this is a couple of days ago on The View. Oh, wait a minute. You know what? Hold the phone. Please hold the phone. Hold something. Look at you. Unbelievable. The computer is actually reflecting about 90% of what's going on in my brain right now. It's going 1,000 different directions and ultimately going nowhere. Looking at that unforgivable little hourglass. It's the sound of the fan in the computer having a fit. But the thing explodes. You know, I'm over here in Larchmont. I want to come scoop up my remains. The number again is 646-478-4847. And what I wanted to play was this. But, oh, this doesn't play. I'm sorry, I forgot. This is locked up, too. Oh, man. It's a nightmare. Let's see. Is this it? I don't even know where I am. Boy, can you reboot a show? All right, here's this one. Let's see if I'll replay this while I'm looking for the other thing. Nothing's working, folks. If you're listening to the first 10 minutes of the show, just kind of feed forward if you're on the... So here's this Hasselbeck thing. Hasselbeck. Here we go. From The View.
Conference with Arizona Governor Jan Brewer, and said it's time for Americans across this great country to say we're all Arizonans now. And in clear unison, we say, Mr. President, do your job, secure our border.
I wish you would stop speaking for everyone. We are not all Arizonans. She has an issue with immigrants. At least they finished the job.
That's an Anto voice, by the way. They have Joy Behar chiming in.
Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. My son's in Arizona.
That's right. He was born
in Arizona. You know, I think that
does. How does he feel
about all of that? I'm going to ask him, and I'm going to let you know tomorrow. I'll send Tim here with Taylor's message. I do think the one thing that we need to pay attention to, what she said and what a lot of people have been saying for decades, is we need to do something about the border. I also think, you know, there's a valid point to be made for giving permanent status to those who are here already.
She's not for that.
And then start fresh and then work on a way to do that. She's not for that.
She's not for
right.
That.
I mean, there's been,
the
I remember being in Amnesty International. There are programs that can fix it. Mm. I think she's asking for that.
The thing that I was caught by with what she said also in her statement was that she wondered why, if they're illegal immigrants, why the police aren't looking at them already, because they supposedly were supposed
to
be already.
Here's the thing. You become illegal when you've been here past your due date or
when your visa expires.
So there's a lot of people who we could be looking at, but isn't the point, this has been the bitch for 25 years. if you're going to do it, then you've got to do the job. But if you're going to keep cutting programs and there's no money and then you spend it and there's this and then, you know, it's peeing in the wind, really.
This Governor also Brewer, I think, is up she's fighting for her political life, too. So a lot of this is political. It's not because she cares that much about it. She just wants to win.
And
that's going
on. Just wants to fight for her brand name.
Right, exactly, so she can make more money.
All right, there you go. And by the way, the Nats have pulled ahead 3-2 in the Mets, so I'm going to be very upset here in a minute. Actually, I'm going to stay upset because I'm so just, everything's ass backwards tonight.
Woo, woo! You know what I'm saying? Then you got the flows. They didn't trip off the flow masters.
That decoration, man. Just the decoration.
There you go. So the Mets are down 3-2 again. Another one of those situations where an accident becomes a disaster, where a guy just sticks his bat out and he gets a double. The ground ball gets in the third, and of course the Mets, unlike themselves, give up the sacrifice fly. Nieve, who's been totally abused by the team, gives up the sack fly. So the Mets are losing with six outs to go again. So we'll go. Maybe we'll tune into the eighth inning here once we get through this little segment here. So let's do some news here. Da-da-da-da. Where it is? Some news. Where are you? Some news. You know, I think I'm just going to play this one here.
Boozy, boozy, bop, city bop.
All right, so let's take a look around the horn here. There's a lot of things going on this week that have kind of caught my soma eye. We've been discussing off and on the show for the better part of a year now the policies and media surrounding the swine flu. Well, they got a little sick of that. Didn't really work. Vaccine didn't work. The fear didn't work. None of it worked. Kind of backfired on them, actually. So, let's go find one that we can sink our teeth into. And they found one. MRSA. Yes. It's back and better than ever. So, let's see if there's any news on that here as we surf around. Because it MRSA, as you know, is the a bacterial infection that usually is found in locker rooms. What do you do, hit the guy? And you see it a lot in high school gyms and things like that. And it's a very serious condition. Sometimes you'll see it with senior citizens in hospitals, things like that. And the treatment is, let's just say it's not stable yet. But there was an outbreak. We had to get scared. So let's see if we got any news here on that. All right, 10 times as many kids with MRSA. MRSA. And let's see what the report is here. As the allopaths come out and do their damnedest. Let's see if I can find it here. All right. And to the allopaths, I say, Babs.
You filthy criminies.
That's right. Okay. We're working with a really unsteady computer, but let's just see if we can find it. A study published in the journal Pediatrics showed 10 times as many cases with MRSA. It is a staph aureus condition in children's hospitals in 2008 as there were in 1999. The number of regular staph infections remains stable. Probably the most scary news is that most of the MRSA cases were caught outside the hospital. The authors noted that clindamycin, the antibiotic used to treat it, is being prescribed more often, and there's been an increase in the strains that are resistant. Smart bug! The more things staph becomes resistant to, the fewer tools you have to fight it. The authors are recommending doctors choose carefully whether to prescribe clindamycin or not. What that means for you is don't get frustrated when your doctor won't give you antibiotics. Wow. So this has a little bit of a subtext to it. Here's the treatment. It doesn't work, and basically there's more infections, but don't get mad when you don't get the drug that doesn't work. There are quite a few docs who refuse to give antibiotics now for simple things like ear infections and strep throat. Wouldn't you want to see if there's really an infection and match it up? It's amazing. Antibiotics won't work on viral infections. Every time you take antibiotics you don't need to take, a new resistant strain of the staph can develop. So basically in 10 years, we've over-medicated the population. the bug has gotten smarter, and there's been more opportunistic infections as soon as 10 times what there were in 1999. Some docs want to do a culture but get talked into prescribing because mom and dad are tired of hearing Junior cry all night. And since it's Friday afternoon, they really want to wait till the weekend. So really what we need is to get earmuffs for the kids, for the parents, I mean. As the Mets are going to implode here and give up another run with two outs, 4-2 Nats, it's a triple. And that must be, could only be one guy. It's got to be Willie Harris. All right, let me just make sure that our nemesis has done what he usually does. Oh, it's Carlos Guzman. So there you go. So the Mets are going to lose another game that they should have won to the Washington Nationals. This is such a horrible season booting up for the Mets. They were a while ago. We were lauding them at 14-9, and now they can't score. They can't seem to get through the late innings without giving up a big hit. And they just gave up. What did the guy? He walked the guy, and then a triple to right center field. This Fernando Nieve has been in so many games. It's pathetic. And well, the Mets had their chance. They basically let him one out last inning. And warming up in the bullpen. Oliver Perez. Wow, this is really the end. Hopefully they'll fire the manager this weekend and we'll have a new thing to talk about. The Yankees are losing 6-2 in the sixth. That's all I care about tonight. All right, so there's that story on MRSA. We had the government elections yesterday where our inspector got beat out. Tea Party, they pushed through what's his name? Rand's son there. And there's been some scandals. We saw some scandals in politics this week. I might go over them towards the end of the show because they were kind of a little saucy. We had a guy that was doing a like an infomercial about abstinence, and he was having an affair with the woman he was doing the infomercial with. And another guy lied about his or distorted his government record with the military in Connecticut. So we'll get to those guys, but let's shift gears, and I'll see if I can get my computer together while this is playing, and we'll listen to the dulcet tones of me interviewing Rick Leskowitz yesterday. You know what? I'm gonna give this 10 more minutes because I told him at 9:30 I'd start the interview, so we'll give him that. Yeah, let's do that. All right. So you know what? Let's do a little look and listen here. This is a little summer cast live down in the nation's capital. It was 2-2 when we started. Now the Mets are down 4-2. And they're down 5-2.
That brings home Guzman, and it's 5-2, Washington.
This is ugly.
Ryan Zimmerman's second hit of the night, his 24th run batted into the season.
Now, that's about 3 or 4.
That'll be all for Fernando Nieve. So another rough day at the office for Nieve. After giving up the 3-1.
Nieve has not been effective in about
take his exit here, and
4 straight starts. Easy. But we have a little dinner theater here. As Oliver Perez is going to come in here now, walk the ballpark. So that'll be fun. See what happens with that. Let's skip over to the Crankies. And let's see what they're doing. 6-2 in the sixth here. Now, they lost, a game on Sunday that they normally don't lose. Mariano giving up the grand slam. They come back and win the game Monday night, but they definitely deserve to lose. And then they get beat last night, and it was all set up for them. Second and third, one out. You think they're going to get a single and win the game, and they actually lose the game. Tonight, they come in, and the Rays just steamroll them. The Rays are like 28-11. And they have no fear of the Yankees. And they never really have the last 3 or 4 years. They really have. They've been fighting with them in spring training. You know, again, dealing with rivalries here. You know, the Yankees train in Tampa Bay. So you have a team from Tampa Bay. You have Yankee fans all around them all the time. And there's sort of like this sibling rivalry that goes on with these teams. It's fascinating because the Rays are always young. They're always sort of upstart. And the Yankees have this sort of like, who are you? You know, flicking them off them like flies. And they used to pound this team because for 10 years they were like a 90-loss, 95-loss team. In the last 3 or 4 years, they've been pretty competitive. So 6-2 Rays as they play the sixth. Looks like two out. Yankees got a runner on first, so we'll see if that game changes. When we come back after the interview, we'll see if we get anything close going on, because the Met game is becoming a slaughter. And it's just so sad. All right, he walked the guy. So the Yankees have 2-1 with 2 out. And, you know, any game at Yankee Stadium, like the last two games have proven, no lead is safe.
This is Wrigley Field East.
Hey, just pop it up. So we'll see what happens here in a minute. Like I said, coming up at the bottom of the hour, I'm going to replay the interview I did with Rick Leskowitz from thejoysoxmovie.com about a lot of the dynamics between the crowd and the fans as it relates to, intentionality. Dealing with things like, you know, when you're rooting for something as opposed to rooting against something. You're rooting for something, are you coming at it with fear, or are you coming at it being open and being hopeful? And dealing with this as a meditation in baseball, because like I said, there's so much ebb and flow between every at bat and every inning and then every game and then every series and the way it goes, very fractally organized. So that's why baseball, unique to all sports, is a good way to get in touch with a lot of these things. Oliver Perez is on the mound. Okay, let's get a look. 5 minute listen here to this. When last seen, he was getting bombed in. There you go. Thank you, Gary. Thank you, Gary. So now he's coming in with a guy on first and two out. Mets are already down 3. This is one of those games where you're going to wake up tomorrow morning and it's going to be like the hangover is going to be very, very, you know, vicious for us. Because the Mets will be 3 games under 500 as they take the field tomorrow night after losing this one.
That coming out of the bullpen and knowing he only has to face a few batters,
well,
that Ollie might be more inclined to try and
take a listen to Gary Cohen.
I would think so. I remember when I was banished to the bullpen.
It's Ron Darling.
I remember when that happened. I threw Dodger Stadium. I came.
Now he's facing Dunn, who had a rope off the wall the last time with the knuckleballer.
Of the moment.
And Ollie being eco, the fidgeting is fascinating to watch.
Sometimes you let it go.
Second relief appearance, the last one was 2002. Obviously not his primary function in the world. And it's a pitch by Ollie. And slam foul. Back to the crankies, let's see. Oh. The Yankees have the bases loaded. I'll get back to that in a minute. Now the Yankees have certainly had the tying run of the plate. Oh, I hate them. Oh, and Jeter's up. Oh, we got drama. All right. We'll skip Ollie here for a minute because who cares? Jeter's up. One Jeterian swing and this game is tied. So he's out of the inning. The guy makes an error. You hear the crowd energy changing. Isn't that Yankee demand? The Yankee fans are so used to winning that any little break, look, they're all on their feet. So sickening. They win all the time. Wow. 351 career with the bases loaded. This is why I hate the Jeter. Hate the Jeter. Ugh. 2-0. By the way, Ollie walked that guy. He always does. We'll go back and visit the Ollie Perez walkathon in a minute. Jeter, the 2-0. And it's upstairs, 3-0. Oh, man. Gets a strike. This is play-by-play on the Blog Talk Radio. Hate the Yankees. Hate them. Remember, we're going to learn in the interview here, rooting for is much better than rooting against, children. Let's see.
Grounded to short. Gobbled up by Parker. And again, Jeter
6-3, and they're out of it. All right. And Ollie looks like he's out of it here. Let's see. Let's see what he did. Got a walk, and then he, let's see what he did here. Lined out the second. All right. So the Mets come up down by 3, top of the 8th. So I'm going to dip away and play the interview now, as I promised, here at 9:30. So if there's anything left of either one of these games, we'll be back to start the show at about 10:15. Anyone that's interested, I'll be in the chat room. I'll open that up right now. You guys got any comments, anything you want me to answer, take a look at our Soma Pal, see if some anything interesting going on Twitter or in the Met chat room or anything like that. So I'll be over there. And, you know, we'll go back and forth on it. But basically, you know, I had those political stories I wanted to get to as well. Any questions about the MRSA thing, you know, as far as how to deal with the infection? Again, we're dealing with the fact that when you declare something to be your enemy as opposed to being your opponent, making that distinction, that's going to come across a lot more in the interview as we get into here in a minute. If I can just get this to work. I don't know what it's doing. It's amazing how usually on Mozilla it doesn't do this, but this is on Internet Explorer. Let's see if I can get over there into the Snat Room another way. Yeah, I went right through. Okay. Wait a minute. Now it's going through on the other guy. Okay. So, all right, let's see if we can start the interview now, if I can get this to work. Yes, I can. All right, here we go. So, Rick Leskowitz from thejoyofsoxmovie.com. If you haven't heard him before, he's been on the show once before. And it's about a 40-minute interview, so I'll be back somewhere between 10 and 15 around there to set up the show. And in the interim, if you're tuning in, I'll be in the chat room. Any questions, and we'll get back to you when the interview's over. Here's Rick. Listen to the beginning of this. It's kind of cute. Mark, watch.
Mark. Hey, and joining us now through the magic of NoCostConference.com is Rick Leskowitz from the,
Evil Empire of Boston.
Yes, but also from what everyone else would know, from TheJoySoxMovie.com. And, you know, we've had some gremlins today, but we're here now, so let's take a little a metaphysical autopsy of what transpired last night down in the Bronx, and look at it from your vantage point, both as a Red Sox fan and as a researcher, understanding the history of those two teams and the dynamics involved between some of the key players. How do you explain the momentum switches that go from 5-0 Yankees to 9-7 Red Sox, and then whatever happened in the bottom of the ninth there with A-Rod and Papelbon? If you don't factor in the human side of it and just look at it from a pure baseball standpoint, you're going to get X's and O's. You're going to miss a lot of the things in between. So how can you kind of color in the missing spots here so that people can appreciate the magnitude of what went on down there?
Well, I think it's a combination of factors. And some of it is the intangibles that the movie is focused on. But a lot of it is just the baseball nuts and bolts. And I think there were some strategy decisions that were made last night that have been called into question in terms of, you know, the pitch selection by Papelbon and, you know, specific behaviors and skills that were mentioned. But when you're playing against an opponent who's very talented and who has a very strong home field advantage, even a minor tactical mistake can be blown out of proportion. And I think that, you know, unfortunately, from my perspective, the Yankees are really good at doing that, and that was yesterday was just another example of it. But go ahead.
How much of that is the fact that, you know, if A-Rod was still playing for the Texas Rangers, same situation with Papelbon, not as much mystique, same player, same talent, same background. The fact that he's wearing the pinstripes and he's in the Yankee Stadium and you got 50,000 people basically, you know, looking at that Red Sox uniform as if it's the Taliban, for God's sakes. Does the impact of the intent of all those brains impact this the result more than just the raw talent of the two individuals involved? How would you do the math on that?
Well, I don't think anybody knows how to do the math, but you do have to take into account all the factors. And A-Rod's a good example because, you know, obviously he's a
right.
Hall of Fame player, but up until a couple of years ago, he couldn't do squat in the postseason. So
right.
he had some internal demon or, you know, mental block, whether it was conscious or unconscious, that he couldn't get over. And he had some belief that he couldn't succeed. From his point of view, fortunately, he was able to get over that hump, and now he's you know, he has that confidence in himself. When your fans turn against you and the vibes go against you, that makes it even harder to call on those inner strengths. We've been going through that on a small scale with David Ortiz now, just
right.
coming out of his slump. But, you know, the first month of the season, he was doing nothing. And he was starting to hear some grumbles, mostly from the media, to be honest. Not so much with the fans, with the media. And it looked like it was starting to get to him. A way to kind of, you know, go inside, as they say, and reconnect with his inner core, and he's back on the beam now. If I can put in a plug, I should mention that we have a fan intentionality test going on that every Friday night we ask our supporters to take 5 minutes to just tune in before the Friday night game starts, get their heart centers in alignment, start vibing out the mojo, and aiming it at a particular player. And this year we started with David because he's having such a hard time. And
uh-huh.
the first day we did this group experiment was the day that he hit his first home run of the season. And
is he aware of it? Have you guys been in contact with the club? Is he aware that this is going on?
That's a very good research question. Actually, he's not aware of it, to the best of my knowledge. And
okay.
that's important. You know, if you're setting up an experiment, you don't want him to be aware of it because then you could say his mental, conceptual, cognitive stuff would be taken over. This way, there's just that extra vibe that he can ride with. And, you know, 3 out of the 4 games that we've done this, he's either knocked in some runs or hit a home run or something. So he's it's a small sample size, and you know, only 4 games overall, but it's kind of spooked me how dramatic the impact was.
Yeah, don't tell the Saban matricians. I don't think they have a stat for this yet, but you know, they're very down on any. They think what I do is weird. The Friday night prayer meetings for your DH,
right.
That might not fit into their lexicon as yet. But so let's transition into that, because baseball, like we were talking about before, and when we got cut off, is riddled with a lot of narratives and superstitions and jinxes and curses and ghosts, and there's so many rituals around baseball.
Yeah.
You saw it play out with, again, A-Rod, the lightning rod, with Dallas Braden a month ago cutting across the mound, and then this guy throws a perfect game on Mother's Day. And
there's
a lot of serendipity. It's very strange serendipity that goes on in baseball. What can you, if it's not just cultural, if it has something to do with the dynamics of the competition, the fact that the stadiums have morphogenic fields to them, like, you know, Wrigley Field for years, and of course Fenway. You know, if you just cut through the sort of the story there, what do you think is actually happening in terms of the thought fields around some of these superstitions and belief systems that you know, create a lot of behavior that is from any other context irrational, but it's accepted in baseball?
Well, again, I think there's a lot of
by
levels.
By fan to, and by player, I'm saying.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of levels to the points you're raising. Any particular superstition that a player has, you know, whether it's their pregame ritual, what meal they eat or what order they do things in, they come to believe in it. And initially it may just be a coincidence that they hit a home run every time they do that. But because their power of belief is strengthened by the repetition, it just solidifies their own intentionality. So within an individual person, it can be like a trick, a mental trick to stop
mm-hmm.
them from worrying and obsessing. They just focus on their ritual, the anxiety dissipates, and they get into alignment and can enter into the zone better. But as far as group superstitions, like, you know, the Red Sox, we had this whole nonsense about the curse of the Bambino, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I don't think there's anything mystical about that. I think it was just cultural conditioning, almost, that the media kind of hyped it, and people sort of grew up enjoying being miserable. And there was sort of a cachet about, you know, moaning and tearing your hair out. until things changed in 2004. And now I think the fans enjoy the positive vibe and don't get so caught up in woe is me. But
well,
you know,
a couple of championships and a couple of parades later, it's easy to do that. How do you juxtapose that to the sort of embracing of failure that you see with Cub fans, where they don't pull their hair out, they just go to Wrigley and sit out in the bleachers and almost like they're watching, you know, Sunday softball. They don't seem to. I mean, they get critical of the team, of course, but yeah, they always show up. They don't seem to have the same expectations. Red Sox, as a Red Sox Nation, as they call it, it's like a tribe up there, is much more in the pathos of the thing, where they suffer and suffer through everything, and they always got close enough that they would, you know, the Cubs don't even sniff a World Series at the time, so it's a whole different sort of characterization of being under the spell. I mean, they got the goat out there with the Cubs, bringing the goat in the stadium, whatever it was a million years ago, that now they can never win or whatever it is. And every year they make the playoffs, they bring some priest in to do some indoctrination in the dugout. Is most of this intentionality around that you study, is it about rooting for a result or rooting against a result? Like rooting against last night, which one of those two things is more germane here?
Well, it's more powerful to root for something than against something else. And that's a concept that was told up to us by some of the physicists that we spoke to, by some of the spiritual healers that we spoke to, and by some of the intentionality researchers, that it's a slogan that you hear in sort of pop psychology too, that if you oppose something, you're just giving it more energy, whereas if you get into alignment with what your highest ideal or highest goal is, then things just flow from there. So the physicists talked about when you're in a positive frame and all the fans are enthusiastic and appreciative and joyful, you set up a standing wave, an actual vibratory pattern with the electromagnetic fields that is hugely powerful to anyone who taps into it. But if you start, and that's more when a Red Sox fan would be saying, you know, go Sox. But if a fan gets into the frame of mind of Yankees suck, that destroys the whole standing wave. It destroys the subtle energy pattern that they've been feeding off of, and it takes a lot of readjustment, because in Boston we're really into cursing out the enemy, and it's just literally not as effective, energetically speaking, as to root for your home team.
Now, how do you take something as celebratory and sort of seems parallel to the game outcome, but it's much more part of the fan experience of singing the Sweet Caroline in the seventh inning, which I didn't even know when that tradition started, you know, maybe in the last 10 years or so. I don't remember it as a kid.
Yeah, no, that's right. And, it's more recent.
And it's become, you know, a cachet, I guess, for teams. I mean, I've actually heard Sweet Caroline at Ranger games, at hockey.
Oh, really?
I've heard it at Mets games. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought it was just...
Yeah, and I always thought that was kind of lazy on the part of the teams to just co-opt the Red Sox song. It has nothing to do with baseball, nothing to do with anything, and yet, you know, I don't know, did you guys go through a sampling of different songs? I don't know what Neil Diamond has to do with the Red Sox, but it seems that song, is there a connection I'm not aware of?
Well, the only connection I've ever heard of is that the Caroline of the song is Caroline Kennedy, and it was sort of when she was a little girl that he wrote it, and, you know, they're a Boston family, so it's got that sort of familial cultural link, but it is, relatively speaking, pretty random as a song to be chosen. But it does have a measurable impact. And one of the tests that we did, a field experiment for the movie, was use some of the computer technology that was developed at Princeton University called random number generators, and took it to Fenway Park to measure, during the course of one game that we studied, measure fluctuations in fan focus and intention. Because it's a weird field, but people can measure the impact of human thought on machines, even though there's no, you know, wires or electrodes or anything like that. So we were able to measure the ups and downs during the course of a game, and, you know, most of the time it's just a slight blips on the screen, if you will. But there were about 6 or 8 moments during the game with very high levels of coherence, as we call it, and six out of the seven moments happened during key game events, like when a rally was going or when somebody hit a home run. And the moment, the one moment that had the highest intensity throughout the whole game was when the crowd was singing Sweet Caroline. So something about that song, that music, the emotion, the vibration of the vocal cords, who knows what, it created a very powerful group coherence. And, you know, I think that's why, that's part of the draw of the game, because it's really fun to get caught up in a positive group emotional experience like that. And it just sweeps over everybody. And, you know, the team gets caught up in it as well. So there's a whole...
Well, it's again, unique to the Red Sox, again, because the fan base is so neurotic, is that, you know, now you're dealing with a second layer of things. Because back in 2004, when you guys won it the first time, social media was in its infancy. It wasn't that big a deal. Even 2007, it wasn't really, I'd say, in the public eye, it was coming into the middle of the bell curve. How do you think social media, since this is a social brain event where there's a group effect, is impacting the, because of the rise of fantasy baseball, all the other things that go on that are sort of, you know, cottage industries around baseball, is it cluttering up the thought, the data sphere with a lot of different intentionalities? Because I've seen guys, there's a movie out, I think it's called Fantasyland, where you have guys that are diehard fans of certain teams, you know, and they track them throughout the season. And you could have a situation where your guy is say it's A-Rod, and he's up in a critical situation in a game, you know, maybe like last night, and you're a Red Sox fan, and you have A-Rod on your fantasy team. How do you deal with all the different conflicts individually in terms of as a fan dealing with your intent? Because if you're rooting for or rooting against, if you have that type of a contradiction or that type of a, you know, where you have your personal gain and the group gain, is it an identification thing? Is it more of a psychological thing?
Well, you have competing forces here. It's not
right.
Like a pure field, like, you know, some of the original tests were done in the laboratory where people would meditate with a computer. And it's a very isolated situation that's screened so that there's no electromagnetic radiation or anything like that. And you can get very clear results. In real life, though, out in the real world, there's all sorts of emotions, cross currents, you know, just coming and going. So it's sort of which weighs out as the strongest. And that's why it's been difficult to make some of these measurements in a baseball game, for example, because you got, you know, half the people rooting for one team, half the people rooting for another. And it can often cancel each other out. And that's where, again, the intentionality of the individual player, the focus and the belief of the individual player, is the overriding key factor. I had an opportunity to ask these questions to Esther Hicks. I don't know if you know the Abraham material. Because I was, you know, curious how important is the group stuff, how important is the individual stuff. And she or he or they, I don't know what pronoun to use, but...
You guys are familiar with this Abraham Hicks. They're a couple that could probably slip into the Cape innocuously with any other senior citizen couple where you're trucking through, and they have been traveling the globe probably about 30 years now, maybe longer, doing their workshops. And it's a, for someone who's coming from the mainstream, it looks like a very strange thing, but for someone that's, you know, in the swimming in the channels that me and Rick swing, and it's very typical, very normal, that they're basically dealing with information that is non-local, and it speaks through them, and they don't filter, and they come up with a lot of wisdom this way. That's collective wisdom, and you're having a conversation. I mean, my initial contact with things like that was through Jane Roberts and Seth Speaks,
right,
you know, about 100
right,
years ago.
Right.
So same kind of principle. So what you say?
That the group phenomena is important, but it's not crucial. It's only helpful to the extent that it allows the individual players to get into their full alignment, or what she calls downstream thinking, or being in the vortex. And that is the overriding factor. So individual focus, whichever, if you have two teams with two competing intentions, whichever side has the strongest and clearest alignment will be the side that wins. Regardless, all the time. That's her sort of
mm-hmm.
basic law. That's, you know, assuming that you have a basic skill level, because you can't, you know.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know,
I mean, you can't do brain surgery with this. You need the left brain. The motor system has to match the sense. Most people, they're screwed up on the sensory side, not the motor side. Motor side's easy. It's just the sensory cortex for action. A parallel book to this is David Hawkins' book, Power versus Force, that sort of gives you a mathematical or logarithmic scale of emotions of how, you know, different negative emotions might basically, you know, screw up your energy and mute it a little bit or not let it carry as far. So when you see it teams like, you know, there was a meltdown today in the Cincinnati-Milwaukee game where the Reds scored 3 runs in the bottom of the ninth. They've won a bunch of games early in the year. They're in first place. I think 10 games in their last at-bat, something crazy, like half their wins come in their last at-bat.
Wow.
When you see teams get on a roll like that and start, this is a time of the year where they start taking on more of, you know, they start to gel, they start to, because we're heading into the league play and they're playing
right. Their
rivals, and that really was what I was trying to get to in our discussion, you're bringing these two teams, you know, Red Sox and Yankees, we've got the Yankees and Mets this weekend, when and right now the Mets are playing the Braves, when you have a history with the opponent, and when teams start to form an identity, like the Reds are forming an identity of being a team that wins late, you know, wins close games, how much of that is those 25 guys, you know, becoming one communal brain, and how much of that is the laundry, as Seinfeld will say, you know, that because they're playing for this team, because you see the guys get traded, you know, their performance might change the scenery. Is the team chemistry concept overblown, or is it just not able to be quantified like some of the more, you know, obvious things that players can do with producing statistics?
Yeah.
Where you're dealing with behavior over 6 months, you know, and dealing with, you know, other factors, like the thing that happened with Hanny Ramirez down there in, he used to be the Red Sox, down there with the Marlins, this big conflict. They just beat the Mets 4 straight. Horrible losses for the Mets. I should be in therapy right now, but what I went through over the weekend with what they put me through. And Ramirez was, you know, he was a sort of a supporting cast player in a lot of these wins. And he kicked the ball around last night against Arizona, dogged it after the ball down the left field line. The coach pulls him, the manager pulls him out of the game, benches him today. Big controversy. And all of a sudden, all these, you know, suppressed locker room type conflicts come rising up in the media. What role do you think that kind of stuff plays, off the field stuff, locker room stuff, you know, factions within teams, plays on over the course of a season in terms of the way a team can handle the ups and downs of a 6 month regular season?
Yeah, well, you're right. We only see the, you know, putting their best face forward in there, you know, when they're playing the games and talking to the media. But what goes on in the locker room is where I think a lot of the emotions get processed. And, you know, you got a lot of people in close proximity with a lot at stake for a long period of time. You need to have some members of the team who can help deal with emotions. You know, and I'm not saying a staff psychiatrist, but teams that click will have a couple of the older, wiser guys who know how to defuse tension. And, you know, players will tell you that team chemistry matters, and that I think that was what allowed the Red Sox to be successful in 04. They had some really likable guys who were low-key and didn't get bent out of shape by the little things, and that helped them ride out the pressure. So the teams, you know, I don't know how you quantify team chemistry, but when you see
right.
it, you know it, and it's valuable.
Yeah, and again, it's one of those things that as someone who's studying the dynamics between sports and science, and you're dealing with a lot of people that are kind of come at it from the testosterone side of the coin, you know,
right.
on the wedding, your friends of the bride, friends of the groom, that want to analyze it, they want to put it into a box and say and stick a fork in it. And these are very effusive, kind of almost elusive and evasive aspects that unless you're there, it's much more of a visceral knowledge than it is a cognitive thing. I don't know how they could possibly translate the two.
Well, that's why it's a challenging field. Like, everyone acknowledges that there's a home field advantage. And, you know, in different sports, different amount of points is usually given to the home team by Las Vegas and the odds making. But what's the reason for that? Is it just because you don't have to travel and you get to sleep at home and home cooking and all that? Or is it the vibe from the home field fans? Is it, you know, Fenway magic, as they call it, or Yankee Stadium magic? Which actually, just as an aside, you mentioned morphogenetic fields, that there's some kind of
yeah.
energy field that is imbued in a certain space, that, you know, destroying the old Yankee Stadium and building a new one, I wondered whether that would have some kind of negative impact. It doesn't seem like it has, but...
No, I think they're 10-11-3 at home, and they play in this bandbox now that they pop it up. It goes over the fence, and it's
Right. It's the home runs are easier because of the wind currents. But
and who knows now with the stadium down, the wind currents might get even worse as it gets warmer out down there. So again, dealing with rivalries, that's you see it a lot with Philadelphia on the National League side with the Mets, where they got caught accused of cheating last week in a game way out Colorado somewhere, and the manager. Instead of dealing with the Phillies manager, instead of dealing with the situation at hand, he goes and blames the Mets. The Mets are too good at home. Maybe we can check the Mets. So it's almost like, same thing with the Red Sox and the Yankees, is that non-local connection, that no matter what you're doing, you know, your nemesis is on your mind, because baseball is it's unlike other sports, you know, you're going to play 18 times a year. So you do
get
that negative intimacy to the point where you know every strength and every weakness of everybody on the other side, and that's kind of, to me, that's kind of the beauty of it. The fact that, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of Red Sox fans in Red Sox Nation hearing this that don't want to know this, but Derek Jeter's in their head. I mean, they know every little nuance of every little thing he does. It gets on their nerves.
You're right. And,
you know, and it used to be like that with Nomar, with the Yankee fans, and so over time, is it more beneficial from a mind-body standpoint? And again, we're talking with Rick Luskowitz from thejoysoxmovie.com. Is it more beneficial to have an appreciation of your opponent, not enemy, opponent, than it is to sort of constantly, you know, spew the hate at them? Like, and it's funny, Yankee fans, I watched them last night, you did, of course, as a Mets fan, and they were screaming things at Papelbon between pitches when he hit Cervelli right before the second home run that... You know, I don't think one of those words could be uttered at a dinner table. And yet, you know, the next pitch is in the left field stands.
Yeah.
So this, the whole idea, like you said before, it's not an absolute. This is the rhythmic part of this work that makes it difficult to understand. When people say coherence, they tend to think signal or noise. And it's signal / noise. It's a ratio.
Yeah.
And if you have that awareness that it's never a complete polarity, that it's a dynamic, you're trying to get a signal-to-noise ratio that evokes a positive physiology. And if you're, and I always say, love and hate, you're still close to the fire. You're still paying full attention. So sometimes the signal-to-noise ratio has both components in it in there, and it makes this sort of mosaic of energy that some players can ride the wave, and some players, like I said, A-Rod would always get crushed by it in the playoffs because he felt the need to do it himself and not ride the wave. And that's sort of you know, the lesson there.
Yeah,
you know,
no, I think that's a very good explanation of it. I don't know whether Papelbon got rattled last night. He didn't admit it, at least to the reporters that we read about today. But it's possible that, you know, that negative intensity rattled Papelbon and didn't particularly affect the Yankees. Maybe they've learned to translate all those, you know, Bronx cheers into a positive energy. Because ultimately, you want the players, it's all energy. They can take it in. Whether it's a cheer or a boo, and you use it to, you know, infuse their system.
Well, this is one of those things where you get into the archetypal aspects of pro sports. College sports have a different culture to them. You know, I was trying to compare Yankees Red Sox to, like, Yale Harvard or Ohio State Michigan or Alabama Auburn, where you're dealing with turf wars. They're so close, and they're so, you know, the people interact. You know, much more, and you sort of saw it in the old days here, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when the Rangers and Islanders would play, you know, in hockey, and the fans were basically interspersed with each other. And we'll see it again this weekend when we have the Subway Series here. But it's always a big fish, little fish, big brother, little brother kind of a conflict. Even Jets Giants, which is a whole incestuous mess that I saw firsthand about a month ago at the draft party, where the two teams basically totally disrespect each other but have to get along for political reasons. But when you see, you know, the sheer extremes of dealing with rivalries like this, to me it's a comfort zone in a way to understand this, like you just were saying before, that the layers go beyond the superficial experience, and you actually get As I think you mentioned before, what's his name? Dr. Murphy out there in the West Coast.
Oh, Michael Murphy, yeah.
Yeah, Michael Murphy. Big Soma guy, by the way. That when you look at our culture, professional sports as an outlet, as a medium, as an experience, even from a spectator point of view, it's our lazy way of getting to the Eastern, you know, state of stillness because of the fact that there are moments when, if you're watching the game and it's tight like it was last night, I know what I was watching Feliciano last night, the bases loaded in the Braves game.
Yeah.
Well, you're sitting there, and all you can do is feel your heart beating your eardrums,
right.
Your feet on the floor, and you're just sitting there, and the time goes away.
Yeah.
And you're 5 years old again, and you're back there, and it is an intrusive reliving to go through it in the agita. But the thing is that wave, riding that wave, and it's an entrainment. And as a baseball fan, because it's so kind of, you know, pastoral, and it's so, you know, basically kind of, you could background noise for the most time. Then when you get to the critical junctures, the extremes, unlike other sports, hockey, basketball come to mind, where there's such a fluid dynamic to it. Baseball can go from completely calm and nothing happening to, oh my God, I don't believe what I just saw, as one, you know, just channeled Vin Scully or somebody. There was Jack Buck, somebody like that. I don't believe what I just saw. So how do you deal with, you know, with the sort of attention span of the average fan, where you're dealing with, you know, especially when if you're trying to teach this as a principle to life circumstances, when most of life is ordinary, mundane, very, you know, things stay within the bell curve, and all of a sudden something extreme happens to them. How do you use these principles of intentionality to cope with those types of things, those kinds of unexpected transitions and traumas and dramas that come up, and not succumb to blowing it off on, oh, I'm cursed, or, you know, all the things people will give up their turf to, and then attract more of it, as Abraham Hicks would say.
Well, you know, American as a culture, we have very short attention span. Sort of ADD is ADHD is very universal. So it takes something special to get people's attention totally focused and totally wrapped up. And meditation hasn't been big in our culture, but sports has been. And I think for many people, that's the closest they get to experiencing being in the zone, or the Tao, as they would say in the East, where you lose your sense of, you know, your own personal separateness, and you transcend, and you become part of something bigger than yourself. So sports is our most popular way, I think, of doing it. And Michael Murphy talked about the incredible degrees of mind-body coordination that athletes have to develop in order to succeed. And that's what led him to make the comparison that sports is the yoga of the West. And, you know, it's a really powerful analogy. It happens to be our path. It's maybe not as elegant and spiritual-looking as the yoga of India, but people can get into transcendent states through sports. And, in fact, a really great book that Michael Murphy wrote is called The Zone, Transcendent Experience in Sports. And he interviews a lot of athletes, pro and amateur, who describe what the subjective experience of being, you know, totally present during a sports game. And it sounds like, you know, religious experiences. So it's a very
and
cool
from
concept.
Dealing with teenagers and college students here, they get to the same state in a very shortcut way when they play the video games, especially when they're playing against the person, you know, in a tournament, where it is this sort of, you know, high-speed technological chess match that at a certain point, just like, you know, if you're out there, you know, water skiing or whatever, there's a sense of communion with the surroundings that the boundary takes, you know, much more of a, you know, an ephemeral state where you don't feel that separation. You feel that communion.
That's right.
And that's, I think, why we're going, why we still go to these things. And I guess, you know, I guess that's kind of segue into how we can wrap it up here. There's something called the Global Coherence Initiative or something. I think I might have butchered the name of it, but it's a project that the folks from HeartMath, all the usual suspects that are interested in this concept of coherence, which to me is sort of the keystone to whatever Health 2.0 comes to. We get out of the health and disease debate, and we start restoring coherence to people's lives. And they're studying it on a global scale, like you were talking about before, with the random number generators and looking at the Earth and the whole Gaia element. So how do you take your principles here that we're talking about with human systems and deal with it with living systems? You're talking about some of the sacred spaces within the stadiums, holding memory. How do you apply intentionality to a planet? How do you get to the point? Because, you know, but I'm more for
you know, a sporting event is like a convenient focus point, and it's what we value now. But I think the whole culture is recognizing that something bigger is at stake. And, you know, like this oil spill in the Gulf, that's I think, going to really be a wake-up call for a lot of people that there's a lot more at stake than Yankees Red Sox, and the planet is in risk. And that's going to trigger, you know, planetary consciousness, planetary awareness. Groups like the Institute of Noetic Sciences, I think they're really doing some important groundwork on this behalf. So people can shift their intentionality from the Red Sox game to healing the planet. And, in fact, there's a good initiative I could mention here. It's called Thriving Earth, where people are asked to do exactly that, to harness their intentionality towards the healing of the planet. And, you know, again, there's evidence, the work of Emoto, showing that water crystal patterns can change by human thought. You know, the ecosystem is primarily water, so if human thought can influence it in a positive direction, it's possible that we can, you know, enhance the healing, the recovery of the earth from all the things that we've done to it. So I think, you know, ultimately, it starts with baseball, but ultimately it goes towards the planet as a whole.
Well, I mean, that's as good a place as any to just kind of sum up here. Just clear up, we do this a lot in the interviews here. We put a lot of information in front of people. What's the one concept you want people to make sure that they get on the way out of this so that they could start using it, you know, the next day, tomorrow morning at work, whatever, so they don't leave here with any contradictions, as we talked about before, mixed intentions, and they could start applying some of these things to their everyday life?
Well, I would say that your thoughts and your emotions extend beyond your skin, and they're not just contained in your brain. And so it's really powerful, the ability to choose your thoughts, choose your emotions in alignment with your highest ideals, and see what starts to resonate in the outside world for you.
That's a big deal because, again, most people think of their identity as being locked inside their body, and I try to explain it that if you took apart a radio, you wouldn't find the music. So
that's a little
Bruce Liptonism there about
your
identity is an airborne signal, and the proteins in your body are just the receptors to it. And if we start thinking about ourselves as a communion, you know, of cells, and humanity as a human body as one big organism, that feeling of being separate and being scared and vulnerable, all that stuff is as a primitive survival thing, can start to go away. And we can use competition as a way to get cohesion and a way to get to higher levels of entrainment like you're talking about here.
Yeah.
And I think, like I said, why not start with Yankees Red Sox? If we can heal that, I think there's hope for us all. So, all right, well, again, this has been Rick Leskowitz from the JoyousSoxMovie.com. You can this movie, guys, we're gonna get this thing out the door before the fall, or how's this thing going?
Well, we need to get fundraising, and the main obstacle is we have to pay Major League Baseball pretty exorbitant fees to use any video clips of games in the movie. So if your readers want, I mean, your listeners want to see this thing in their local theater or on PBS or wherever we end up showing it, then go to the website, and there's some mechanism for making donations. Nonprofit, so it's tax deductible. You can get your name in the credits if you or your group, your affinity group, comes up with a $100 donation. So get us over the hump that way. That'd be great.
Maybe you got to start one of those prayer groups for the movie while you're working on Ortiz.
That's right. Forget about Ortiz. We want to get the movie done. That's a good idea.
You got to start. Maybe you should bookend the prayer meeting with that.
That's a good idea.
Two for one there. Hey, I work. Then I'll get my name in the credit just for that. So. All right, Rick, hang on for 1 second. We're going to wrap it up. I'll be right back with you. Why don't you guys just keep listening to Soma Time. I'll be right back. All right, there you go. Rick Leskowitz yapping away with us here on Soma Time. And in the interim, we're going to go live to his Red Sox here as they try to hang on. Bottom of the ninth, two out, 3-2 Red Sox, first and second. Tip in, and the Mets have already lost, of course, a while ago. So now this is with no Papelbon. So
We're not dealing with that issue tonight, but let's see who is actually on the mound. I just had to watch the Braves win in the bottom of the night. Thank God I had the sound off. Mets lost 5-3, weren't really competitive, so nothing to talk about there. Yankees are losing 9-2 in the eighth, so that's another slaughter. Slaughter! Red Sox trying to lock it up here. Upstairs. This is, who's pitching for them? Let's see. Can't tell his name. Oh, Buchholz. Buchholz is in there now. No. Sorry, Daniel Bard. Buchholz is out of the game. He pitched 8 innings. So, let's see. We got Tomei up. 2 outs. 1-1 pitch, first and second. Single ties the game. Inside, 2-1. Can't seem to put him away here. See, and again, you're dealing with Fenway. You're dealing with that reactive attitude. Very much like Met fans, Red Sox fans. We want to win. We're very passionate about our team, but there's a lot of negative intent in that ballpark right now. The Twinkies are just sort of a Zen master. They never win at all, but they go into these hostile places and perform. Here comes Tomei. Here's the pitch. Ground ball to home. Looks like it's going to do it. And the Red Sox hang on. All right, well, one way to get out of Yankee Stadium is to go win at home. That's what they just did. So they're on their way. Red Sox hang on. Wanted to get that in for my friend Rick there. So we completed the mojo. Boy, look at the disaster we're in here. Let's see, the Florida Marlins were 0-0 with St. Louis before. Now it's 1-0 Marlins in the sixth, and they've got first and third and 2 out. Hanley Ramirez is in the game, though. This a little aside. His little one-day punishment is over with. And let's see, this is another game. Oh, look at this. Oh, he's out. How the heck did that happen? Is that? What's going on here? This is the Pirate game of Milwaukee.
Is that we all saw the World Series last year, right? Remember Johnny Damon took off and just kept going to third base?
Yeah, I do.
I do believe that play alerted every third baseman. They got the shift on press. This is a third baseman.
Wow, and he tags him out.
So now every third baseman has to be.
So this is, what game is this?
Over to third. I don't think that comes into his mind if he doesn't see the World Series. Great play.
Wow.
Getting drawn right there.
Look
that's
at that.
Fantastic observation. And you think, because of the shift, that Johnny Damon play has been implanted in every third.
Brewers game. And Pirates. That was a 6-4 Pirates win.
That
they tagged the guy out. Was that the ninth inning? Did that happen?
So now,
just check that out.
That, you never saw third
guy overran second base, popped up trying to go to third, and he got tagged out. Let me see. Was that in the ninth inning? No. Looks like it was the eighth inning. I don't know when it happened. Well, it must have been the ninth. Braun reached in a bunt single to third. Fielder struck out. McGee flat out the center. I don't know when that happened. Anyway, what random highlight from the prior game. They sew it up. Wanted to get to a couple of these controversies and some news on Lawrence Taylor here before we sew it up. But this Blumenthal guy, you know, again, the military record exaggeration thing. Here's a commercial from his 2008 speech in Norwalk. Told his audience he served the military during the Vietnam era. All right, so listen to this and see what you think here.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I know you've heard a lot of speeches, and there may be one or two more, but I really want to add my words of thanks as someone who served in the military during the Vietnam era in the Marine Corps. By the way, do we have any Marine Corps veterans here? Raise your hand. Number five. In fact, I'd like all our veterans to please stand. Everyone who served, whatever your branch of service, whatever your...
Okay, now that's just an idle speech taken from 2008, little local speech here in Norwalk. But basically, you know, the truth is the guy was a desk jockey and never saw anything in Vietnam. So, you know, it's another one of these gotcha things. I love the way that they have to go through the whole apology process, and you could just say, I didn't lie, I misspoke. It's a nice little distortion. That it gets into that whole thing of when you have an opponent versus when you have an enemy politically, what do? You take what they say and run with it. Speaking of running with it, it gets worse for Eco Lawrence Taylor, being sued now over a crash from last year. He was charged with leaving the scene of the crime down in Miami. Attorneys for the other driver involved, because he's involved, of course, in the other lawsuit we talked about last week with the third-degree rape charges, actually. So here we go, which is another case that's being, you know, there's more news on that one tonight. But attorneys for the driver involved in the wreck filed suit Wednesday, a year later, saying Taylor was negligent and is seeking damages in excess of $15,000. $15,000, he has that in his back pocket. Police said Taylor, who lives in Pembroke Pines, struck a van as he was driving on the expressway, drove his Cadillac Escalade about 2 miles on the axle before pulling off the road. When police spotted him standing outside the SUV talking on his cell phone, he told police he thought he hit a guardrail. The van's driver, Manuel Castillo, was not seriously injured. So the dude was in the car that he hit? Oh, man. Taylor's awaiting trial dealing with legal trouble in New York. Legal trouble. Anyway, there's your eco news of the day. So, she's... anyway. So that was that. I wanted to... there's one other scandal here. See if I can find it. Real quick for you. About this dude that got accused of, with the I can't remember the guy's name. I gotta go dig it up here. Let's see if I can find it this way. The abstinence video. I mean, it's classic. Here's a guy talking about, Let's see if I can find it. Cause it's just very funny. I mean, to me, it's just. Okay, abstinence. Not really a concept the philos embrace too much, but let's see. Hypocrisy in high places. Abstinent-only advocate caught an affair with staffer. Tremendous. Okay. It really is weird. Tracy Jackson is the woman that was his co-host on the interview. So Republican Mark Souder. We already had the tickle fight guy. Every one of these politicians, it's like one is worse than the other, who announced his resignation from the House this morning over a consensual relationship with a part-time staffer. He's been a big promoter of abstinence. Let's see if I can find the video, though. This video was taken down from YouTube earlier today, but popped up again on a different channel. Okay, so let's see if I can find it. Because it's just so funny to watch the seriousness of this thing. And again, this goes down to teaching, you know, this polarity between the way you want to behave personally and you want others to behave socially. Let's see, here we go. Good old YouTube. Congressional hearing on abstinence education is what this was. Holy cow.
He participated in an April 2008 hearing at which he was one of the only voices in the room speaking in defense of abstinence.
Let's give a minute of this or two.
You've been a longtime advocate for abstinence education.
Think about what everything we heard in the interview when you're listening to this. This is Tracy Jackson having an affair with him, talking about abstinence.
Which discredits many claims purveyed by those who oppose.
Can't make it up.
Education. What did you think of this
hearing?
Here we
go.
Well, I personally feel I should have probably abstained from the hearing.
It
was arguably, although I've seen Chairman Waxman has done some pretty biased hearings, but this was arguably the most biased hearing we've been. First off, from the topic, how has abstinence education failed? Rather than...
So you knew you were going to be fighting from the get-go.
How hard is it to get kids to abstain from sex? Regardless what program you give them, would have been a fair title, the failures of both condom distribution and abstinence education to prevent teen pregnancy would have been an interesting title,
mm-hmm.
because guess what? Nothing works very well. But their argument was based on a report that the Democrats did and asked for that would that said that certain abstinence programs hadn't been reaching the goals that we wanted. Now, the General Accounting Office, GAO,
mm-hmm.
was very careful. They said some of these programs need to be improved, but they didn't make the claims that the Democrats' hearing subject or the chairman made or the media reprinted. Nothing in the GAO report said that abstinence education failed or was counterproductive. However, they did have a number of witnesses that suggested that abstinence education increased teen sexual activity.
All right. Yada, yada, freaking yada. And then he goes and resigns. You can't make it up. Ugh. That was an eco ugh for the night. All right. I'm going to try and wind it down here because I think I've covered the gamut, as it were. See if I can get anything to work here because the computer's been really just sterling tonight, just sterling. So what's up this weekend, guys? I don't know. We got the MacGruber movie coming out. We've got lots of things happening. It's all over the world. If anyone's seen Iron Man 2, I want your comments. Get over there on Facebook. Get over there on Twitter. Get over there on somerspace.org. Pop me an email at nakedsomer@gmail.com. Nakedsomer@gmail.com. I'd love to answer your questions. Get into some stuff. Let's see if there's anybody tweeting anything interesting before we go. I've had such a weird week on the Twitter with all these things going on. We had, like I mentioned, any questions seriously about the MRSA thing, I'd love to handle those because I just want to bat them out of the park. Maybe we'll get someone on next week to talk about that because in 2 weeks we're going to have actually a happy and successful and well-adapted, spiritually guided chiropractor on the show. From one of my Soma Pals lists, Martha Nessler out there from the same town we had Fred Sugar on, about out there in I think it's Springfield, Illinois, like the whole Simpsons thing. But there's just a lot going on out there. It's been such a weird week that way. Let's see. Anything interesting on the tweets? Let's see if anything's trending. Weird night tonight because Idol and all that. And with the draft last night, the lottery. I mean, with that, with millions of dollars passing on a lousy ping pong ball or two. So let's see if I get something from my man Mike Silva here because it's been kind of a baseball theme night. We'll wrap it up with that, and then we'll wind you down here in the summertime. Oh, Buzz Bissinger. Oh, my God. Yeah, he's kind of cranky. Not really looking to broadcast any of this. I think I will sum it up with the Mad Dog here. We dug him out of the mothballs before, and... for our knuckleballer tonight that started for the Mets, here is a flashback to when Mad Dog was on the air announcing a name that just you couldn't stop laughing about. Kind of funny. Just summing up with that.
Did it make it any easier?
So my pal tonight.
You gave me that much of a layup? R. A. Dickey. Let me say that one more time, loudly. R.A. Who's pitching tonight?
There you go. So, wind it up with that. Oh, my God. What a night. So next week, like I said, maybe we'll take a little dippy doo into the social immune system next week and see what's going on with that as we get to an Onto Moon. Another night, I think. Let me double check. Nope, we miss it by a day. 27th is the full moon. But we'll be right there, right on the cusp of the full moon of wistfulness. So we'll play out with that. Let's see if we can find a song tonight when dealing with everything that's been going on here. So if you're out there and you're in the middle of some kind of big conflict and you're going through a lot of strife and you've had all this interference and all this tension come up for you. Just, you know, this is part of the spring, part of the seasonal stuff, part of the things that we have to do in order to grow. We have to change. You can't just grow. You have to change. So if you have any questions about this, like I said, check out the site, somaspace.org, or you can email me questions directly at nakedsoma@gmail.com. And we'll get back as soon as I can. Otherwise, I'll be back here again 9 o'clock next Wednesday night for another edition of Soma Time. Thanks to my guest, Rick Leskowitz from the joyofsoxmovie.com. You can check that out, you know, and donate to his movie. You want to get it out there. It's really, really intense and very comprehensive look at the relationship between fan energy, intention, all that weird science stuff he was talking about. So love to see that get done. Rick and his cousin are great guys, and I want to see that flourish. So thanks for joining me tonight, and we'll see you again real soon here in Summertime. Stay well, be yourself, and travel light through the darkness.
Sapiens.